papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis. We hope that it is some truth-telling about the effort to bring truth-telling to American homes. That's what we define journalism as being. So welcome. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, and I'm here with my colleagues, Judy Patrick, the Vice President of Editorial Development for New York Press Association, and Barbara Lombardo, who teaches journalism at the University of Albany, and David Gustina, the morning host on WAMC. Hi, y'all.
Yo.
Hey, you ready for a rollicking time? Rollicking time.
Well, if you put it like that, let's get rollicking.
All right. We are all veteran journalists in this upstate area, so we have some observations on what's going on. You know, we ought to start out, of course, with something that isn't specifically journalism, which its advocates, its owners have always insisted upon, and that is Facebook, Meta, of course, which is Mark Zuckerberg's company that oversees Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, has announced that it is ending its fact-checking program that was, you know, designed to stop the spread of misinformation. And instead, it's going to turn to community notes, which has been the way that X, formerly Twitter, has now operated. So what do we think about this? Ms. Judy, you want to start us off?
Yes. Facebook will soon become the hellscape that Twitter has become, where you will not have any moderation. They are relying on crowdsourcing for fact checking. So a lot of people are throwing up their hands and trying to walk away from Facebook. I say we all need to step up and go toe-to-toe with the people who are spreading information. The problem is that the disinformation campaigns are well-funded. They have bad motives. And if I throw one shell back into the sea, it doesn't matter. But to be honest, I don't think Facebook's content moderation efforts have been very good anyway. But at least it was something. The problem has long been their algorithms and their lack of transparency. We don't know how it worked. We don't know what they're amplifying, what they're depressing. What we should do is demand of Facebook that they do that. Clearly, Mark Zuckerberg is bowing at the knee of Donald Trump. He is trying to survive this incoming administration. But to dismiss these third-party fact-checkers as he did is going to make Facebook less relevant. You know what? At the end of the day, it's going to be bad for Facebook. I think people will leave just as they're leaving Twitter. I'm one of those blue sky converts. I love the place. I think we're getting far better information than we were getting on Twitter.
Rex, you started this by saying that Facebook is not journalism. And while it's true that they don't adhere to the tenets of journalism, what they are distributing is what people consider news. And it's not how we would define news, and it's not necessarily credible news, but people are still turning there for news. The problem, and I totally agree with you, Judy, is that people are still going to turn to their Facebook page if that's what they are in the habit of doing, and then hopefully seeing what isn't credible, they're going to dismiss. I'm tempted to not advise people to engage and try to weigh in and say, this is disinformation, this is false. It's almost a useless exercise.
Well, you probably won't see it because it's not part of your feed. The problem is that the people who are seeing the disinformation are not your friends. And so you're going to miss a lot of that. Isn't that right?
Doesn't it come down to the algorithms? I think so. I think this is all part of what has become the disinformation network around the world, which is largely contained in social media. And Barbara and Judy, you're so right. I mean, people think it's news. That's where they get their news, even though we as journalists know there are certain criteria and values that you should be following to be considered the news of verification. Now, you take a guy like Mark Zuckerberg and any one of these billionaires. We have another story about a cartoonist who's just left the Washington Post because of the cartoon.
We'll get there.
But it's basically a bunch of rich guys going, let me just put a little
a moisture on my finger and hold it up to the wind and see where the power is going. And where is it going? It's going with Donald Trump, who, of course, has been threatening the media all along. And this time, he's been really ratcheting it up, including lawsuits. We're seeing all sorts of things begin to happen. So what do you think a guy like Mark Zuckerberg, who has to make a what? Profit, is going to do? He's going to turn to power and genuflect.
He's making plenty of profit without having to do this, and he could easily afford to continue to do fact-checking. For them to dismiss the fact-checking and instead pretend that people can just write in or call in or type in and use that as a way of determining what's true is frightening.
He said, fact-checkers are too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the U.S.
And he thinks by moving them from California to Texas, then he'll get better fact-checking operations or he'll get better moderation, which is just crazy. You know, underlying all this is the fact that disinformation on social media can have real-world consequences. It can lead to riots. It can lead to people killing other people. It can lead to mass discrimination.
So, it could lead to people believing that a riot wasn't a riot. It was just tourists at the Capitol.
Good point, David.
Yeah, it's actually fairly outrageous. But it does underscore the point that the social media platforms have been making, that they are not journalism, because no reputable journalist would make this kind of a statement. You know, they're protected under Section 230 of the Federal Communications Act. That is, platforms are not liable for fallacious content, not liable for anything that appears on their platforms, unlike the newspapers that we used to edit, where we had to be very careful about everything to be sure that we were trying as best we could to give people the truth. There is no such obligation on the shoulders of these platforms.
That's the big mistake, isn't it, Rex?
Well,
that's the loophole there, isn't
could
it?
Be.
That really has hurt us.
You know, and it is that has given them insulation from lawsuits, that has enabled them to become multi-billionaires, Zuckerberg and, well, the previous owners of Twitter before Musk got his hands on it. But this actually underscores the fact that they have no commitment to truth.
And if they are going to discontinue the fact-checking part of this, and you can see where all these young people have been damaged by social media.
Yeah.
I mean, states are now exploring laws, like in New York, to stop cell phones in schools and too much time on social media. That's what's happening as a result of this. So the real-world consequences come down to the mental health of a lot of children and many adults.
Absolutely true.
Hey, let me climb really high on my soapbox and say, mainstream media, we do the right thing because there are laws that we can be sued. But we also do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, because it's our responsibility, our obligation as journalists to make sure that what we're producing is fair and accurate. That is more a guiding principle than the threat of being sued, even though I agree. I think these social media platforms should be considered publishers and should be drawn into the same legal restrictions we are. But I also think that the people that run these organizations need to take a higher moral standing on this.
Hmm. You know, I love the metaphor that was used by an Axios reporter named Scott Rosenberg. He responded by writing this. Decades of human experience online shows that running any kind of community platform is like gardening. If you let the weeds go wild, the flowers will choke. This isn't John Stuart Mill's free market of ideas. It's a world where bad speech drives out good speech. And that's certainly the case. You know, the problem with engaging online is, as I was saying earlier, most of the bad stuff that gets out there, we're not going to see it. We're not going to be able to contend with it. We can't weed that particular garden because that garden is growing outside our reach, if you don't mind carrying the metaphor that far. But the people who believe it, of course, this is why Donald Trump was elected, because so much bad information is out there that enabled people to believe it.
And some of the false tellers are relying on the falsity of the First Amendment, saying, hey, we have a First Amendment right to say anything, and we don't want our views to be censored. But there's a difference between truth and lies.
Are we partly to blame, though? The mainstream media, let's just say that for a moment, because our criteria leans to the sensational. And when you have commercial outlets fighting for ratings, right, then you end up skewing the reality when a lot of people think the world's falling apart all the time because most of those stories are skewing to a negative frame. Do we hold, in commercial media especially, do we have some party to this? Do we have some blame? Because the other part of this is that human nature is I'm going to look at the worst thing. I'm going to look at the car crash. Give me what I want. Give me what I want.
Well, that is actually part of our evolution. That is our negativity bias. Psychologists talk to us all the time about how that is human nature. And so people do look to that. And I agree that it is more problem commercial media than non-commercial, but the drive to get an audience is certainly strong here on public radio. Otherwise, you don't exist.
No question. And our job is not to report that all the planes landed safely at the open airport today. I will give you that, Rex.
Yeah.
But there's something there with that commercial model, to me, that tweaks it into an area that gives credence to those that want to attack the media for being too extremist or too sensationalist, and even gives them a wedge into saying that they're fake media.
So you were making a point, David, earlier about the resignation of the noted cartoonist for the Washington Post, who drew a cartoon that was killed by her editor, which cartoon depicted actually the Post's owner among the rich people bending at the knee of or worshiping Donald Trump.
Cue the dark music.
And this was just the latest person, Antelius actually is the name of the cartoonist. This is just the latest instance of Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Washington Post, it is being said. The latest loss at the Post, a lot of their top reporters are leaving in the wake of Bezos' decision to kill the editorial endorsing Kamala Harris before the last campaign. So what do we infer about that, about ownership of our media properties?
Oh, boy. I was really disturbed by this, and I almost knee-jerked to say, should I be canceling my subscription? But my cooler head prevailed for the moment. But, boy, my assessment of the Washington Post, because of its ownership and lack of leadership, is really going downhill. And if they are going to silence a political cartoon, that's only a hair's breadth away from the commentary and a hair's breadth away from the news coverage.
Now, political cartoonists get edited like everybody else. And the argument from the Washington Post was that we've done this too much. This is too repetitive, which I didn't go for because this was not a one-day story. This is a continuing story where for the last month or so, we have seen powerful people, mostly men, go before Donald Trump and cave and acquiesce to whatever he wanted. So it demanded repetitive treatment. And it was not convincing to me that, oh, we've had too many of these. This is just more of the same. We need to go on to a different topic. No, this is a topic that we still find relevant to talk about today.
What company owner is going to allow themselves to be made the butt of a political
someone
commentary.
Who understands the importance of journalism. This is the problem that we learn right in that instant. I don't care what anybody says. This is Bezos saying, you're not going to put me in the cartoon. I mean, come on. This
well, he didn't have to say it. An editor on his behalf said it.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
But I think we can read those tea leaves and see what has happened here. This is not a responsible owner of media. He only cares about it in relation to his portfolio. And it's a big mistake, right? Because we're talking about it.
Actually, that's true. And even the New York Times ended up running that cartoon, though the Times historically and rather proudly does not run editorial cartoons. They ran it as a visual with the news story about this resignation. So it is getting more attention than it would otherwise have gotten.
It was a bad decision by him, in my opinion. He made it now an object of discussion, and the Times is wrong for not running political cartoons.
Times are tough, and Times is wrong.
But when you look at a political cartoon, you can get a lot more information out of that cartoon than you'll ever get in the article that's written in the same way.
You know, this is not an isolated incident in Los Angeles. Dr. Patrick Soon-Shing, the owner of the LA Times, now requires that headlines on the opinion page get run past him. Isn't that an amazing decision?
I fell on the floor when I heard that one because, again, outrageous, also inefficient, especially when you're trying to put out a daily newspaper. But such a control freak should not be owning a newspaper.
It's not a control freak. They're afraid. This is fear. He has put fear into them and their industry, and they're worried that they're going to get the ire of the president of the United States. And so they're skipping their little feet as fast as they can and getting the message out, we're not going to be any trouble for you, Mr. President. It's fear.
And he doesn't trust his staff. That's the other thing that's so undermining for the
whole. Well, he's the one that's going to, or she's the one that's going to get blamed in the end. So they're going to try to take control.
Let us note, by the way, I mean, I have to say this. We cannot generalize from this that rich people shouldn't own the media, because I know that there have been instances where that has proven good. For example, the Philadelphia Inquirer, under the ownership of Jerry Lenfest, was still a place that was very strong. A billionaire bought the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Now the Minnesota Star Tribune, it won two Pulitzer Prizes under his ownership. There are a number of, and I would say I worked for a great publisher who happens to be a very wealthy guy when I was the editor of the Times Union, and did not have this kind of interference, by the way.
And you could do really great investigative journalism and have your publisher back you up, have the money, the funds to fight any lawsuits that came your way.
That's a good point. That's right. If they're rich enough, they can stand up and say, oh, yeah.
And you can see that being lost. I feel like this week has been a huge loss in the media when you watch this genuflecting going on to the administration with this building of lawsuits. Now we got CNN involved in another potential one here. This is not good for the media and...
or for the public. It's dangerous when you have...
ultimately for the public, right?
Right. When you have the owners of gigantic media outlets controlling what they don't believe ought to be published. Their commitment is not to news and to the public. I'm not sure what the heck their commitment is to, but they should not be distributors of news.
There's a peril, though, if you step aside from some of that wealthy ownership, and that is actually confronting NPR and PBS right now.
Well, wealthy is okay. As you said, it's okay if they're wealthy.
Yeah.
They need to be wealthy to be able to afford to have it, but they need to have the morals that Judy talked about earlier. Judy, I'm worried about you. You fell from a soapbox to the floor in one discussion.
Are you okay, Judy?
Dangerous. A little bruised.
It's all right.
Bruised,
it's all right.
Undaunted.
NPR is going to have to reach out to their wealthy donors, I think.
NPR is in trouble because there is going to be a fight. And this is probably more intense than it has been before. While there has been claims that there is going to be defunding of public broadcasting ever since the presidency of Ronald Reagan, this time it could actually happen, because we've got the guy who is at the right shoulder of the president-elect, that is Elon Musk, basically attacking public broadcasting. It's about $535 million from the federal government goes to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which in turn provides funds to PBS and NPR stations. And while that money is something that the loss of it would be felt here, if I'm understanding correctly, David, at WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, it would not be fatal. But for a lot of the little stations around the country, the rural stations especially, that could make the difference between staying on the air and not.
And I think we can honestly say it would be damaging to WAMC. Could be meaning the loss of a reporter or two. We are also not getting as much in underwriting these days. And that is another issue that's plaguing a lot in public media. And when you have this fund, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, that in the past has always been fought over, there's always, especially from Republican administrations, that they're going to take the money away. And that's largely not happened. We'll see what happens this time. But as you referenced, Rex, this is one of the easiest things for the DOGE department, for example, to say this is not necessary funding. You'll have to figure it out yourselves, public media. We're taking it away. And that should alert our listeners and hopefully have their ears perking up that we are really in a dangerous time for the media and public media. And we're going to need your support now more than ever.
Hey, you know, I think there are even larger things to be worried about here, because the thing that conservatives and Donald Trump often talk about is privatizing things. Can you imagine if they tried to privatize public radio stations and then, in fact, turn them into commercial operations in some form? That would even be more an egregious takeover, because the legacy of public media has always been to bring information, arts, entertainment to people who wouldn't normally have access to that information. And I agree with you, Rex, about the need to service rural areas, because we get so much information on our phones nowadays, but remains a strong case to be made for over-the-air broadcasting, especially in these rural areas. And that, in many cases, that's the way they get information. Hey, talk about what's happening in California with these wildfires. I'm sure radio is playing an important role in getting crucial information to people about evacuations or where to go for help and shelter. So radio is important, and we need to protect it at all levels.
Yeah, and you might be listening to it live on a radio, or you just as likely might be listening to it live streamed or live using their website, using any of those apps that let you listen to the radio.
Let's just point out that when you hear the long station ID at the top of the hour here at Northeast Public Radio, you hear a lot of signals mentioned. That's not accidental. Those were commercial signals at one time, and
correct,
those commercial stations died because they weren't financially viable. The only reason that those signals exist is because they were taken over by public radio, and they are still beaming this program that you're hearing out into areas that wouldn't otherwise be served.
Yeah, one of my concerns is not only the likelihood of NPR getting the axe from the federal government under the people that are coming in, but also the creation of a state radio, that is chilling and not impossible. I know we have Fox News, the closest thing to that at the moment, but...
But we should say, on a positive note, that it is the California wildfires, other disasters, weather situations, mass shootings, where the media shines.
Absolutely.
Where they come in, they're there, they provide a crucial source of information for people in a time of need. We cannot lose that. If you think of one thing... Think about those wildfires and how many people were able to evacuate and be safe because the media was there to report it.
Hey, last time Fred Rogers came and saved the day for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, he's not here anymore. Who will be the next Fred Rogers?
That's a really good question, because there isn't such a visible, and Big Bird is now licensed to HBO, so...
Oh, no. Rex.
Who's going to save public broadcasting? It's really a difficult situation. You've got the new head of the FCC, Donald Trump's incoming chairman, a guy named Brendan Carr, who has sent a threatening letter to ABC already, saying Americans no longer trust the national news media to report fully, accurately, and fairly, and alluding to the fact that ABC has settled for $15 million, this lawsuit filed.
We told them not to do that.
We told them.
No wonder the Washington Post cartoon had Mickey Mouse laying down in front of the Trump
statue.
Absolutely. That was a great little touch in that cartoon.
It sure was.
It's pretty terrible. You know, it's a very difficult time for news media, and I think we ought to take note of the fact when the legacy media do a great job. And I think that your mention, David, of the Los Angeles wildfires bears the scrutiny of this, particularly in the early hours of the specifically great work of the Los Angeles Times and CNN, as well as many others. But if you are the major news organization in a community, as the Los Angeles Times is for that metropolitan area, you are the place where people are turning online, on their phones, any way they can get to it. That's where you're turning for information, and they've apparently done just a terrific job.
Well, and it's just one more sign of our understanding of what's happening with the climate, right? Because part of the job of the media is to point out these issues that are happening. And one of the things that I haven't heard so much in the early reports of these fires is it's linked to climate change. And we're just seeing more and more, including in our own region in New York, we've had wildfires as recently as the early fall. So we are seeing things that are happening now that, as a news event, may also have to be told in larger context.
And in different forms. We've talked about this before, but a Pew study is finding how much 1 in 5 Americans now regularly turn to influencers on social media for news. Influencers. And what I think that underscores is the responsibility of those of us in the media business to try to pick up some of those skills. Wouldn't it be great if the greatest reporters became influencers, if they had the opportunity to reach people? You're looking skeptical, Judy.
No, I know. What I was thinking about was the fact that most of the influencers that they name are people I follow and people I read. And I was thinking of you, Rex, as well, because you have a column on Substack. This is one of the ways influencers reach out. I mean, and what you're trying to do is develop a following and impart a wisdom that you've acquired over time, and you try to make it worth the reader's time.
Seems to me you have to have a hook of some kind, right? You got to go into it with a hook. You have to have a certain kind of personality. You have to do it in a certain way. Your approach has to be interesting, where journalists in general don't want to show a lot of personality, themselves out of that shell, that's what's harder for mainstream journalists.
Well, Kara Swisher comes from a reporting background, and I know a lot of reporters with hooks, you know, with personality, who have kind of suppressed it over time, and I think we should lean into this one.
I think personality is more genuine. It's more truth. If you're sitting there trying to hide who you are from the general public, that shows through as well. People can tell you're being more reserved. But if you just be you, that's the most honest thing you can do. Now, I'm not talking about the language you're using or the stories you're covering. I'm talking about your personality. Show who you are to the public, and you're likely to get a better reaction and response.
Build relatability, drive engagement. So maybe those can be some of the watchwords for 2025 for the legacy media. That is all we have time for today. Amazingly, what a great conversation.
You are incredible, Rex. You wrapped that up beautifully.
Thank you. Maybe I have a future in media. David Gustina, our producer, is here. Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to you for joining us. We hope to come back again next week for the Media Project.
Stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.